Hence our beloved Dionysus did not bring in ivy as an aid to drunkenness, nor as an enemy of wine, he who plainly named himself, in the case of unmixed wine, methi and methymneos. Rather, it seems to me that, just as wine lovers, when no wine from the vine is at hand, resort to a drink made from barley, and some make apple wines, others date wines, so too he, longing in wintertime for a garland from the vine, since he saw it bare and leafless, came to love the resemblance offered by ivy. For indeed the twining, wandering habit of its tendril, and the moist, loosely spreading growth of its leaf, and especially its cluster of berries, which resembles a thick bunch of unripe, ripening grapes, closely imitate the character of the vine. Nonetheless, even if ivy does contribute something toward relieving drunkenness, we shall say that it does so by its heat, opening the pores, or rather by helping to concoct the unmixed wine, so that, for your sake, Trypho, Dionysus may still remain a physician. To this Trypho fell silent, considering how he might reply. But Erato, calling on each of us younger men in turn, urged us either to come to Trypho's aid on behalf of the garlands or else to take our garlands off. Ammonius said he granted us free rein, since he would not argue against whatever we might say. So then, with Trypho too urging me to speak, I said that proving ivy to be cold was not my task, but Trypho's, since he makes much use of it as a cooling and astringent agent. Of what has been said, I went on, it is not true that ivy mixed with wine causes drunkenness, for the condition it produces in those who drink it one would not call drunkenness, but rather derangement and disturbance of mind, the sort of thing henbane produces, and many other such things that madden the mind. As for the convulsive twisting of the tendril, that argument is unsound. Effects contrary to nature are not the work of powers that act according to nature. Wood, too, warps, when fire forcibly draws the moisture out of it, taking on curvatures and distortions. But heat that is akin to a thing is, by nature, disposed to increase and nourish it. Consider rather whether it is not, instead, some weakness and coldness of body that naturally produces its many bends and its tendency to trail along the ground, since it meets frequent obstacles and checks, like a traveler who through weakness often sits down and then goes on again. That is why it needs something to twine around and lean on, being unable to hold itself up and guide its own way, for lack of heat, whose special power is to move upward. Snow melts and runs off ivy because of the moistness of its leaf, for water quenches the snow's structure and breaks down its porous looseness, since snow is a mass of small, closely packed bubbles, which is why snow melts away no less in places that are extremely cold and damp than in places exposed to the sun. And this being evergreen, or, as Empedocles calls it, steadfast-leaved, is not a matter of heat, for shedding one's leaves is likewise not a matter of cold. The myrtle, at any rate, and the maidenhair fern, though not among the hot but among the cold plants, are always in leaf. Some, then, think that the leaf persists because of an evenness of blending. Empedocles, in addition to this, attributes it also to a certain proportion of the pores, which let nourishment pass through in an ordered, even way, so that it flows insufficiently. But in leaf-shedding plants, this does not happen, because of the looseness of the upper pores and the narrowness of the lower ones, since the lower ones fail to send nourishment up and the upper ones fail to retain it. But instead, having received only a little, pour it all out at once, as happens in certain uneven irrigation channels, whereas plants that are continually watered hold out with a sufficient and well-proportioned supply of nourishment and remain ageless and green. But when it was planted in Babylon, it withered and gave out, and this noble plant did well to do so, since, as a client and dependent of a Boeotian god, it had no wish to emigrate among barbarians, nor did it envy Alexander for making himself at home among those foreign peoples, but instead fled and fought hard against being exiled from its own land. The cause was not heat, but rather cold, unable to bear the opposite temperament. For what is akin does not destroy, but is welcomed and sustained, as time, though it is hot, is sustained by dry soil. Whereas the air surrounding Babylonia is said to be so stifling and heavy that many of the wealthy, once they have filled skins with water, sleep upon them to cool themselves. Florus wondered how it was that Aristotle, having written in his treatise on drunkenness that old men are most easily overcome by drunkenness and women least of all, had not worked out the cause, a man not in the habit of leaving such things unexplained. He then put the question before the company to consider together. It was a dinner among familiar friends. Sulla then said that one case reveals the other, and that if we could correctly grasp the cause in the case of women, we would no longer need much argument concerning old men. For their natures are most opposite in moistness and dryness, smoothness and roughness, softness and hardness. And he said one should take this first with regard to women, that they have a moist constitution, which, being blended into their flesh, gives them its softness and its smooth sheen, as well as their monthly purgations. So whenever wine falls into so much moisture, it is overpowered, loses its own strength, and becomes altogether diluted and watery. One can also find some support in Aristotle himself, for he says that those who drink all at once, without pausing for breath, what the ancients called gulping down, are the least likely to fall into drunkenness, since in their case the unmixed wine does not linger, but is driven through the body by its own rush. And we generally see women drinking in just this way. It is likely, too, that their bodies, because of the continual drawing down of fluids toward their purgations, have come to be full of passages and cut through, as it were, with channels and conduits, so that the unmixed wine, falling into these, quickly drains away and does not settle upon the principal parts, whose disturbance is what causes drunkenness. As for old men, that they lack moisture of their own, their very name seems to me to declare first of all. They are called by this term not because they are flowing into the earth, but because they are already becoming, in their bodily state, something earthy and earth-like. Their stiffness and hardness of joint, and further their roughness of skin, likewise reveal the dryness of their nature. So when they drink, the wine is naturally absorbed, since their body, because of its dryness, is spongy. And then, remaining within them, it produces shocks and heaviness. For just as floodwaters wash off dense ground without making mud, but mix in more thoroughly with loose, porous ground, so too wine, drawn in by their dryness, lingers within the bodies of old men. And quite apart from all this, one can see that old men's nature by itself already displays the very symptoms of drunkenness. For the most conspicuous symptoms of drunkenness are trembling of the limbs, stammering of the tongue, excessive talkativeness, quickness to anger, and lapses and wanderings of the mind, most of which are already present even in healthy old men, needing only a slight tip of the scale, any chance disturbance. So that for the old man, drunkenness is not the production of symptoms peculiar to itself, but simply an intensification of symptoms he already shares with it. A proof of this is that nothing more closely resembles an old man than a young man who is drunk. This, then, is what Sulla said. Apollinides the tactician said that he accepted the account concerning old men, but that, in the case of women, he thought the point about their coldness had been left out. The coldness by which very hot unmixed wine is quenched and made to lose its striking, fiery force. Since this too seemed plausible, Athrialetus the Thasian physician, injecting a further difficulty into the inquiry, said that there were some who supposed women to be, not cold, but hotter than men, and others, even more, who held that wine is not hot but actually cold. When Florus expressed surprise, he said, "The argument about wine I leave to this man," pointing to me, for we had, in fact, happened to discuss this very point a few days before, "but as for women," he went on, "they think they can demonstrate their heat first from their hairlessness. The residual matter that would otherwise form hair is consumed by their heat, whereas, when it is in excess, it turns into hair. And second, from the abundance of their blood, which is the source of the body's heat, and which is present in women in such quantity that it would set them ablaze and consume them with fire, if frequent and rapid purgations did not occur. Third, this fact about funeral pyres proves that females are hotter than males. For it is said, by those who arrange such things, that they place one female corpse among 10 male ones and burn them together, since a woman's flesh contains something resinous and oily, so that it becomes kindling for the rest. Further, if the more fertile is the hotter, and girls come into readiness earlier than boys and are stirred toward procreation sooner, this too would be no weak proof of their heat. Still greater and more persuasive is the fact that they bear cold and winter weather easily, for most women feel the cold less than men do and generally need fewer clothes. But I think, said Florus, that the doctrine is refuted by these very arguments. For in the first place, they resist cold better because like is often less affected by like, And further, their generative seed does not come about through a process of cooling, but they merely supply matter and nourishment to that which comes from the male. And again, women cease bearing children much earlier than men cease begetting them. Moreover, bodies burn better because of fat, which is thought to be colder than the rest of the body. At any rate, young men and athletes who are least fatty burn worst. The menstrual purgation is a matter not of abundance, but of corruption and poor quality of blood. For the unconcocted, residual portion of it, having no fixed seat or stability in the body, is expelled through weakness, becoming altogether dull and turbid through the feebleness of its heat. Indeed, the fact that women undergoing this purgation generally feel chills and shivering shows that what is stirred up and departing from the body is cold and unconcocted. And as for their hairlessness, who would say this condition belongs more to heat than to cold, when he sees that the hottest parts of the body are the hairiest? For it is heat that pushes all such growth outward, scoring and opening up passages in the skin's surface. Smoothness, on the other hand, comes about through density produced by cold. And that women are denser textured than men, my dear Athreoletus, you may learn by asking those who still sleep beside women anointed with perfume or oil. For they become saturated with that very unguent while sleeping beside them, even if they do not touch or come into contact with the women at all, because their own body, through its heat and looseness of texture, draws it in. Still, he said, the case about women has, on the other side too, been argued in manly fashion. But as for wine, I am eager to learn from where it has furnished us any suspicion of being cold. Do you suppose, I said, that this argument is mine to make? Then whose is it? He said. Well, I recall, I said, having come across a discussion of this very problem by Aristotle himself not long ago, but that was sufficiently long ago. Epicurus, too, in his Symposium, discusses this at length, and the sum of it, as I take it, is this. He says that wine is not hot in and of itself, but contains within it certain atoms productive of heat and others of cold, and that when it enters the body, it sheds some of these and takes on others from the body, according to whatever temperament or nature it happens to meet there, so that some people are warmed by it while others, when they get drunk, experience the opposite effect. This, said Florus, carries us straight off to Pyrrho by way of Protagoras. For it is plain that if we go through olive oil, milk, honey, and the rest in the same way, we shall end up shirking any statement of what each thing is in its own nature, and simply claiming that each becomes what it is through its mixtures and combinations with other things. But how do you yourself go about arguing that wine is cold? In this way, I said, I was forced at the time to improvise under pressure from two considerations. The first that occurred to me was the practice of physicians. To patients who are enfeebled and in need of some bracing tonic on account of stomach ailments, they administer nothing hot, but give wine and so bring relief. And likewise they check fluxes and sweats with wine, which arrests and strengthens the failing condition of the body no less, indeed even more than snow does, by cooling and constricting it. If wine possessed a heating nature and power, it would be much the same, I think, as applying fire to snow or undiluted wine to the heart. Again, most people say that sleep comes about through a chilling, and that most soporific drugs are cooling mandrake and poppy juice, for instance. But these act with great force and violence, compressing and congealing, whereas wine gently cools, brings things to rest with pleasure, and calms motion, the difference between the two being one of degree rather than kind. Further, what is hot is generative. Moisture makes for a good flow, and heat rouses the breath into vigor and strength. But those who drink much undiluted wine are duller in sexual intercourse, and so nothing strong or well-formed toward generation. Rather, their intercourse with women is feeble and incomplete, owing to the poor and chilled condition of their seed. And indeed, all the effects that people suffer from cold happen also to the drunk. Trembling, heaviness, pallor, tremors in the limbs, vital spirit, slurred speech, stiffness and numbness in the sinews of the extremities. And for most people, drunkenness ends in paralysis, whenever the undiluted wine altogether stuns and quenches the natural heat. Indeed, physicians treat the bodily harms of the drunk and hungover, at first, as it seems, by wrapping them up warmly and putting them to bed, and the next day by bathing, anointing, and feeding them, with foods that, without disturbing the body's bulk, gently call back the heat that has been scattered and driven out of the body by the wine. In general, In observable phenomena, we track down hidden resemblances and powers. There is, however, no need to be puzzled over what drunkenness itself actually is. For, as we have said, the drunk closely resemble the old. Which is why heavy drinkers grow old earliest of all, and most of them go prematurely bald and gray before their time. And all of these conditions are thought to overtake a person through a deficiency of heat. Further still, vinegar is a certain nature and power belonging to wine, and nothing among things that extinguish fire is more combative toward it than vinegar, but overpowers and stifles the flame more than anything else, owing to its extreme coldness. And we see physicians using the wine-like fruits in preference to others, as cooling agents, in the case of pomegranates and apples too. And do they not make honey wine by mixing the very nature of honey with rainwater and snow, since the cold destroys the sweetness through its affinity with the astringent, once it prevails? Did not the ancients, for this very reason, dedicate and consecrate to the god, the serpent among creeping things and the ivy among plants, as having some cold and frost-like power? And if, because a great deal of undiluted wine, when drunk on top of hemlock, seems to cure its effects, some take this as evidence of wine's heat, we for our part will say, turning the argument around, that when mixed with wine this poison becomes incurable and kills outright those who drink it. So that it is no more plausible to suppose that wine counteracts hemlock by being hot than that it cooperates with it by being cold, if indeed it is by coldness, rather than by some other nature and power. That hemlock is more likely to destroy those who drink it. Certain young men, who not long before had been frequenting the old philosophical discourses, were tearing Epicurus to pieces, on the ground that it was neither decent nor necessary for him to have inserted, in his Symposium, a discussion of the proper season for intercourse. For an older man, they said, to bring up sexual matters at a dinner attended by young lads, and to raise the question whether one should make use of it after dinner or before dinner, was the height of licentiousness. Against this, some of the company invoked Xenophon, as leading his fellow drinkers away after dinner not on foot but on horseback, to have intercourse with their wives. But Zopyrus the physician, who was thoroughly versed in the arguments of Epicurus, said that they could not have read Epicurus, Symposium, attentively. For Epicurus did not make this a set topic from the very beginning and structure of the work, and then carry through arguments on it, but rather, after rousing the young men from dinner for a walk, discussed it for the sake of moral discipline, and turned them back from their desires, on the grounds that the act is always precarious and liable to be harmful, but worst of all for those who indulge in it right after drinking and eating. But if, he said, this had actually been the express subject of inquiry, whether the philosopher had done well not to have considered at all the proper time and season for intercourse, or whether it is better to do such things at the right time and with due calculation, and whether it is not out of place to consider the right time in general, though shameful to do so at a symposium and at table, it seems to me that one might rather bring the opposite charge against a philosopher, that he should discuss this subject in the daytime, in his lecture hall, with many people of every sort present, rather than over a cup, among intimates and friends, where it is also fitting to slip in a myth, however dull and flat, along with the wine. How then is it shameful to say or hear something useful, said for the benefit of the practice of intercourse? Indeed, for my part, by the dog, I would rather have had Zeno's ideas about intercourse arranged in some symposium, as a matter of play, than lodged in so weighty a treatise as the Republic. At this the young men, struck dumb, lay silent, and when the rest asked Zopyrus to go through Epicurus, arguments on the subject in detail, he said that he did not remember the particulars precisely, but that he believed the man feared the shocks arising from intercourse, on account of the throbbing of the body, which throws it into disturbance and agitation when people walk about in such a state right after. For in general, he said, undiluted wine, being apt to strike and to set disturbance in motion, displaces the body from its settled position. And if, when our frame is in this condition, calm and sleep do not take hold of it, but instead other movements come through sexual acts, while the parts most naturally suited to binding and holding the body together are squeezed and wrenched, there is a danger that the mass of the body becomes unsettled, as though shaken from its foundations. For at such a time, he said, the seed does not flow well, there being an obstruction on account of the body's fullness, but is torn away forcibly and mixed with other matter. For this reason, the man says one ought to engage in such acts once the body has come to rest, and the distributions of nourishment and the fluxes have subsided as they pass off and depart, but before the body again becomes in need of further nourishment. One might also adduce, in support of Epicurus, the medical account as well. For the time of day, once digestion has already reached its resolution, is safer, whereas the impulse toward intercourse right after dinner is not without danger. For it is unclear whether, since the food has not yet been mastered, indigestion would receive the shock and throbbing arising from intercourse, so that the harm would become twofold. Olympicus then took up the discussion and said, for my part, I am altogether pleased with the saying of Clinias the Pythagorean. He is reported to have been asked when a man ought especially to approach a woman, and to have replied, whenever you most wish to be harmed. And indeed what Zopyrus has just said makes some sense, but I also see the other occasion as having its own difficulties and drawbacks with regard to the matter. Just as Thales the wise man, when troubled by his mother urging him to marry, somehow slipped away and put her off by saying to her, at first, it is not yet the time, mother, and later, it is no longer the time, mother. So too, I think, it will be best for each man, with regard to sexual matters, to be in such a condition that on lying down he says, not yet the time, and on rising, no longer the time. That is athletic talk, Olympicus, said Socleris, still quite reeking of the Cotabus game and of that meat-eating crowd, and not to the point here. For there are young married men present, by whom works of affection must be performed, and Aphrodite has not altogether fled from the rest of us either, but we even pray to her, no doubt, saying in the hymns to the gods, turn back old age above, O fair Aphrodite. Let us consider, then, if you please, whether Epicurus rightly and fittingly, or against all justice, deprives Aphrodite of the night. And yet Menander, a man well versed in love, says that of all the gods it is most fitting that she share in it. For I think, darkness was well devised as a veil for pleasure by those who set about doing these things, so as not to drive out, by encountering them in the light, the sense of shame from the eyes, and thereby implant boldness in licentiousness, along with vivid memories, by dwelling on which desire is fanned into flame again. For sight comes to us as the sharpest of the body's experiences, as Plato says, and by rousing the soul intensely with images close at hand toward the phantoms of pleasure, it always creates a new and fresh desire. Night, on the other hand, by removing most and the most frenzied of such acts, leads on and lulls our nature to rest, not letting it be driven by sight into excess. Apart from all this, what sense does it make for a man who has come home from dinner in high spirits, crowned with a garland, if it so happens, and anointed with myrrh, to turn away and cover himself up to sleep? And yet in the daytime, in the midst of his business, to summon his wife from the women's quarters for some such purpose, or in the early morning to be coupling like a rooster. For evening, my friend, is a rest from labors, and dawn their beginning. And the evening is watched over by Dionysus Lycios together with Terpsichore and Thalia, while the dawn rouses us up toward Athena the worker and Hermes of the marketplace. That is why songs, dances, wedding hymns, revels, feasts, and the resounding din of flutes possess the evening, while the dawn is possessed by the clatter of hammers, the grating of saws, the early morning outcries of tax collectors, and proclamations summoning people to court or to attend on kings or magistrates. A time at which the things of pleasure are far away, and Aphrodite's reign ends, along with the revelries of the young and no thyrsus leaf of Bacchus stirs, for cares press in tight. Moreover, the poet never puts any of the heroes to bed with a wedded wife or a concubine in the daytime, except when he makes Paris, having fled the battle, sink into the bosom of his woman, as though this daytime incontinence belonged not to a man, but to a raging adulterer. And indeed, the body would not be harmed by intercourse after dinner any more than at another time, as Epicurus supposes, provided one does not engage in it while drunk or bursting with fullness and weighed down. For in that case, to be sure, the act is precarious and harmful. But if a man, being reasonably composed and moderately relaxed, his body having grown soft and his mind settled, brings himself to it after some interval. It produces no great disturbance on account of the body's bulk, nor any of the other effects, whether cooling or a shifting of atoms from their place, as Epicurus says, that it causes. Rather, by rendering to nature what is proper to it, and by calming himself in a way, he will fill up again the void, as a fresh influx comes to the empty spaces. But this is rather more to be guarded against. Engaging in sexual acts while still in the midst of one's business, lest the body, being unsettled and agitated, together with the anxieties of the mind, and the exertions and fatigues connected with one's daily needs, at once seizing hold of it, roughen it further, there having been no adequate interval in between for nature to take its rest. For not everyone, my friend, possesses Epicurus, leisure and ease, furnished abundantly and for all time by discourse and philosophy. Many face contests each day awaiting them, and gymnastic exercises, one might almost say, await everyone, for whom it is neither honorable nor advantageous to offer the body, disposed in such a state, relaxed, to frenzied intercourse. As for that blessed and imperishable being, let it be, as it is in itself, unconcerned with our affairs. But we, who follow the law of the city, must take care not to enter upon summer and begin sacrifices having just before accomplished some such act. Hence it is well, having placed night and sleep in between, and having made a sufficient interval and interruption, to rise again clean, as it were from the beginning, and in Democritus' words, thinking new thoughts on the new day. At Athens they begin the new wine on the 11th of the month, calling the day the jar opening. And long ago, it seems, before drinking they would pray, pouring a libation of the wine, that its use might prove harmless and health-giving to them, as a kind of medicine. Among us, the month is called Prostiterios, and on the sixth day of the month it is customary, after sacrificing to the good spirit, to taste the wine, after the west wind has blown. For that wind, more than any other, unsettles and stirs up wine, and once it has escaped this, it is thought thereafter to remain steady and reliable. My father, then, offered the sacrifice as was his custom. And after dinner, when the wine was being praised, he set before the young men studying philosophy, along with us, the problem of inquiring into an argument for why new wine intoxicates least. To most of the company, this seemed paradoxical and hard to believe. But Hages said that sweetness everywhere is cloying and produces satiety, and that for this reason, no one could easily drink of new wine as much as would suffice to make him drunk, since the appetite, put off by the unpleasant sensation, gives out before it advances as far as quenching thirst. But that sweetness differs from pleasantness, and that the poet, understanding this, says, with cheese and sweet honey and pleasant wine. For wine, he said, is sweet at the start, but becomes pleasant only when, through the process of digestion, it changes over into austerity as it ages. Aristaenetus of Nicaea said that he recalled having read in certain writings that must mixed with wine stops drunkenness, and that he reports some physicians, when men have drunk too much, bid them vomit, and then, when they are about to go to sleep, dip bread in honey and eat it. If then, sweetness in some way dulls unmixed wine, it is reasonable that new wine does not intoxicate until its sweetness changes. We were very pleased indeed with the young men's resourcefulness in argument, in that, instead of falling upon the arguments that lay ready to hand, they found a supply of their own. For the obvious and easy points to seize upon are, first, the heaviness of must, as Aristotle says, which cuts through the stomach, and the fact that a great deal of windy and watery matter remains mixed in with it. Of these, the windy part is at once forced out and expelled, while the watery part naturally makes the wine duller. But aging intensifies the wine as the watery element is separated out, so that the wine becomes smaller in measure, but stronger in potency. Well then, said the father, since we have already stirred up Aristotle, let us also attempt to say something of our own about the men called half-drunk acrithorakes. For it does not seem to me, sharp as he is in such inquiries, that he has worked out the cause with sufficient precision. He says, I believe, that in the sober man the reasoning faculty judges well and in accordance with reality, while in the man who is thoroughly drunk perception itself is held in a state of dissolution, but in the man who is only half drunk the imaginative faculty still retains its strength while the reasoning faculty is already thrown into confusion, And this is why such a man both judges and judges badly, following along after his impressions. But how, he said, does this seem to you? For my part, I said, considering the matter by myself, this account seemed to me sufficient as far as the cause is concerned. But if you bid me put forward something of my own, see first whether the distinction just stated ought to be transferred to the body as well. For in the half-drunk, only the mind has been thrown into confusion, while the body is still able to serve the impulses, not yet having been submerged. But when it is shaken down and pressed hard, it betrays the impulses and gives way, since it does not go forward as far as actions. Whereas those other men, though they share in the fault, are exposed not by reasoning any the worse, but by having strength any the more. Looking at it, however, from another starting point, I said, as regards the power of wine, nothing prevents it from being varied and changing along with the quantity, just as fire, if moderate, hardens and sets the clay. But if it strikes it with excess, melts it down and makes it flow instead. And conversely, the season of a fever, when it begins, stirs up and inflames, but as it advances, fevers rather settle down and abate. What then prevents the mind too, when naturally set in motion by wine, once it has been disturbed and provoked, from being relaxed again and settling down as the wine increases? At any rate, hellebore has as the beginning of its purgative action the disturbing of the mass within. But if it is given in a smaller quantity than the proper measure, it disturbs but purges nothing. And some, too, who take sleeping drugs in a quantity less than the proper measure, are thrown into a more troubled state, while others, taking more, fall asleep. It is likely, then, that this disturbance in the half-drunk man, once it reaches its peak, likewise dies away, and that the wine, in large amount, contributes to this. For entering the body in quantity, it burns out along with it, and consumes the maniacal element of the soul. For just as the dirge and the funeral flute at the beginning stir feeling and draw out tears, but as they lead the soul on into lamentation, they thus little by little remove and use up the painful element in the same way, so too you might observe wine, when it has violently disturbed and provoked the vigorous and spirited element, in turn submerging it and settling the mind down, so that, as it advances further toward drunkenness, it grows quiet. When I had said this, Ariston cried out, as was his habit, "There has appeared," he said, "a way back into our symposia for the justest and most democratic of measures, which has for some time been exiled by a certain sober authority as if by a tyrant. For just as the theorists of the canon in matters of the lyre say that the ratio of 3:2 furnishes the concord of the fifth, and the ratio of 2:1 the concord of the octave, while the fourth, being the faintest, is constituted in the ratio of 4:3, so too the harmonists of Dionysus have observed 3 concords of wine with water, the fifth, the third, and the fourth, thus speaking and singing, either drink 5, or 3, or not 4. For 5 parts arise in the ratio of 3:2, when 3 parts of water are mixed with 2 of wine, 3 parts arise in the double ratio, when 2 parts are mixed with 1, and 4 parts arise when 3 parts of water are poured upon 1 part of wine. This is the ratio of 4:3. A sober and feeble mixture, fit for certain officials with sense enough in the town hall, or for dialecticians with their eyebrows raised when they are examining the shiftings of their arguments. Of the other mixtures, the one of 2:1 brings on that disturbing and half-drunk pitch of intoxication, stirring the chords of the mind that are otherwise unmoved. For it allows a man neither to remain sober nor to sink his folly wholly down into the unmixed wine. While the mixture of 2:3 is the most musical of all, altogether a bringer of sleep and a banisher of care, and, in the words of Hesiod, that averter of harm, soother of children, which brings deep calm and quiet to the unruly and disorderly passions within us. To this no one answered Ariston in opposition, for it was plain he was jesting. But I bade the boy take up a cup, as though it were a lyre, and tune the celebrated mixture and harmony, and the slave came forward and poured out the unmixed wine for him. But Ariston drew back, saying with a laugh that he belonged to the theorists of music, not to the practitioners on instruments. The father, however, added only this much to what had been said, that the ancients, it seemed to him, made 2 nurses for Zeus, Ite, and Adrastea, but only 1 for Hera, namely Eubea, and likewise 2 for Apollo, Alethea, and Corythalia, but more for Dionysus, because this god must be tamed and trained in a greater number of measures by nymphs, so as to become gentler and more sensible. Euthydemus of Saunian, entertaining us at dinner, set before us a wild boar of great size. And when those present expressed their admiration, he said that another, much larger, being carried by the light of the moon, had spoiled, and that he was greatly at a loss over the cause. For it was not likely that the sun, being hotter than the moon, should not rather putrefy meat. Satyrus said, "That is not, above all, what one would wonder at, but rather what is done by hunters. For whenever they knock down a boar or a stag and send it off to the city from a distance, they drive in a bronze nail, on the ground that it helps against putrefaction." When we had finished dining, and Euthydemus again recalled the puzzle, he said, "Moschian the physician says that putrefaction is a melting and flowing of flesh as it changes by corruption into moisture, and that, generally speaking, whatever putrefies becomes moist, and that all warmth, if it is soft and mild, stirs up and confines moisture, but if it is fiery, on the contrary, dries out the flesh. From this it is clear what is being sought. For the moon, gently warming things, moistens bodies, while the sun rather snatches the moisture out of bodies because of its burning heat. A point on which I believe Archilochus too spoke with natural insight, when he said that the fierce, blazing dog star withers many of them. And Homer speaks still more clearly of Hector, over whom, as he lay, Apollo drew a shady cloud, lest the might of the sun should wither the flesh about his sinews and limbs. While the moon sends forth rays that are weaker, for by them no grape cluster ripens, as Ion says. When this had been said, I remarked, "Everything else has been well said, but one ought not to judge the whole matter by the quantity, the more or less, of the heat. For we observe that the sun warms less in winter, and yet putrefies bodies more in summer. The opposite ought to happen, if putrefaction were caused by softness of heat. As it is, when the burning heat is more intense, it destroys flesh the faster. So the moon does not bring dead bodies to putrefaction through a lack and weakness of warmth, but rather one must hold responsible a peculiar quality of the stream that flows from it. That not all heat has a single quality, differing only by degree of more or less, but that there are very many powers of fire, unlike one another, is clear from the most ready examples. Goldsmiths work gold by means of chaff flame, while physicians warm gently, above all, the medicines they are compounding by means of vine twig flame. And for softening and shaping glass, tamarisk wood is thought to be well suited. While the wood of the olive, though it treats bodies well in vapor baths, is an enemy to bathhouses and damages their brick lining and foundations by scorching them from beneath. Hence the more fastidious market inspectors do not allow contractors to use olive wood, any more than to throw darnel into the furnace, for the fumes from these produce headaches and dizziness in bathers. It is, then, nothing to wonder at that the moon too should differ from the sun, the one sending forth streams that dry, the other streams that relax and set in motion the fluids within bodies. This is why nurses are altogether careful not to show infants to the moon, for being full of moisture, like green wood, they are wrenched and distorted. And we observe that those who have slept in the light of the moon rise up with difficulty, as it were struck senseless in their perceptions and numbed. For the moisture, being diffused by the moon, weighs down their bodies. It is said, too, that the moon assists toward an easy childbirth, when it is at the full, by the relaxation of fluids providing softer labor pains. Whence, I think, Artemis too has been named Lachia and Eileithyia, being none other than the moon, as Timotheus says outright, through the dark vault of the stars and through the swift-bringing moon. The power of the moon also becomes plain in the case of lifeless bodies as well. For carpenters reject timber cut at the full moon, as being soft and quickly rotting because of its moisture. And farmers hasten to gather their wheat from the thrashing floor while the month is waning, so that, hardened by the dryness, it may better withstand time. While those who transport grain at the height of the moon find it most beaten down, becoming softer through the moisture. They say, too, that flour ferments better at the full moon, for fermentation falls little short of being a kind of putrefaction, and once it has lost its due measure, by loosening and thinning the dough it carries it on to the same kind of corruption. Rotting flesh, too, suffers nothing else than this. The cohesive breath within it changing over into moisture, it is loosened and flows apart. We observe the air undergoing this, too, for it discharges dew most of all at the full moon, as it melts away, as Alcman the lyric poet, I believe, hints when he calls the dew the daughter of air and of the moon, saying somewhere that Herse, daughter of Zeus and of the divine moon, nourishes. Thus, from every side, it is attested that the light of the moon possesses an exceedingly moistening and softening power. As for the bronze nail, if indeed, when driven through, it keeps the flesh, as they say, less liable to decay, it appears to have some astringent quality in itself. For physicians use verdigris as a medicine for such purposes, and they report that those who spend their time in copper mines find benefit for their eyes, and that those who have lost their eyelashes grow them again. For the fine dust that rises from the copper ore, falling imperceptibly upon the eyelids, checks the discharges and constricts the tear duct. This is why, they say, the poet calls bronze man-strengthening and gleaming. Aristotle says, moreover, that wounds from bronze spearheads and knives are less painful and easier to heal than those from iron, because bronze has in itself something medicinal, which it leaves behind at once in the wounds. That the astringent quality, moreover, has a power opposite to that of the corrupting agent that causes putrefaction, and the healing quality opposite to that of the destructive one, is not unclear. Unless indeed one should say instead that by being driven through, the nail draws the fluids to itself, a constant flow being directed toward the affected point. This is why, they say, around that very spot something like a bruise or a stain is seen to appear. And it stands to reason that the rest of the flesh remains unaffected, since the corruption runs together into that one place there. Sosius Senecio, when Polybius was advising Scipio Africanus not to leave the marketplace before making someone of the citizens his friend, one ought not to take friend in a harsh or sophistical sense, meaning that fixed and steadfast kind, but in the common sense, meaning simply the well-disposed man, just as Dicaeochus thought one ought to make everyone well-disposed toward oneself, but to make friends only of the good. For friendship is won only over a long time and through virtue, whereas goodwill is brought on even by need, and social intercourse, and playful company among men of public life, once it has taken the occasion offered by kindly persuasion and the accompaniment of favor. But observe the point of this piece of advice, whether it holds good not only with respect to the marketplace, but also with respect to the symposium, so that one ought not to break up the gathering before acquiring, from among those who have reclined and been present together, someone well-disposed and friendly to oneself. For men go into the marketplace for the sake of business and other needs, but into a symposium, those who have any sense at all come in order to acquire friends, gladdening those who are already friends no less than making new ones. For this reason, it would be illiberal and vulgar to seek some other kind of profit from such company, but to come away having gained more in friends is both a pleasant thing and a dignified one. And conversely, the man who neglects this makes the gathering graceless and incomplete for himself, and departs from it having become a fellow diner to the belly, not to the soul. For a true dinner companion comes to share not only in meat and wine and dessert, but also in conversation, and in playfulness, and in the kind of friendliness that ends in goodwill. For the graspings and pullings of wrestlers require a coating of dust, but for the grip of friendship wine, mingling with conversation, supplies the touch. For it is conversation that channels wine's kindly and character-forming quality from the body into the soul, and helps it along, otherwise, wandering about within the body, wine provides nothing more serious than mere repletion. Hence, just as marble, by cooling the added strength, shrinks it and drives out its excessive moisture and fluidity, it makes the metal that is being hammered and shaped firm. So too, the talk of the dinner table does not allow the drinkers to be utterly dissolved by wine, but checks them, and blends into their relaxation a cheerfulness and kindliness that is well-tempered and pleasing if a man handles it skillfully, as if the softness and pliancy that wine produces were being stamped, like wax, with the seal of friendship. The first question, then, of our fourth set of 10 table questions concerns varied food. It was the month of Elaphebolion, and as we were arriving at Hyampolis for the festival, Philo the physician entertained us, having prepared, it seemed, on a rather lavish scale. Seeing that among the boys who were with Philinus, His son was content with plain bread and needed nothing else, he said. By Heracles, this is what the saying means. They fought amid stones, and there was not a stone to pick up. And he jumped up to fetch something useful for them, and after a good while came back bringing them some dried figs and cheese. When I remarked that this is what happens to people who busy themselves preparing extravagant and costly things, they neglect and run short of the necessities, Philo said, yes, for I had forgotten that Philinus here is raising a little Sesastros for us, who they say lived his whole life on nothing but milk, tasting no other drink or food. But whereas in his case that regimen probably began as a matter of chance, our boy here, being raised by this Chiron in a manner just the opposite of Achilles, fed from birth on bloodless and lifeless food, will before long, I suppose, be shown living on air and dew, like the cicadas, as they say. We, for our part, said Philinus, had no idea we were coming to dine at a feast of the 100 victims, as in the days of Aristomenes. Otherwise we would have come armed, like antidotes, with simple and wholesome dishes against tables so extravagant and inflamed. And this after having so often heard you say that of varied foods, the simple ones are more digestible and easier to obtain. And Martian said to Philo, Philinus is ruining your preparations, turning the guests away and frightening them off. But if you ask me, I will guarantee to them on your behalf that varied food is more digestible than simple food, so that they may enjoy what is set before them with confidence. So Philo asked Martian to do just that. And when we had finished dining and called on Philinus to take up his charge against varied food, he said, the tale is not mine, but this Philo here is always telling us that, in the first place, wild animals that use a single, simple kind of food are healthier than men, whereas those that are fattened up in captivity are prone to disease and easily fall prey to distempers, because they are given food that is mixed and seasoned in various ways. Secondly, no physician has ever been so rash an innovator, or so bold, as to give varied food to a man in fever. Instead, they give the simple, unseasoned kind, as being most obedient to digestion. For food must be acted upon and transformed after being mastered by the powers within us. And a dye, too, masters simple colors more readily. And the least fragrant oil is turned most quickly by perfumers' compounds. And it is the plain and uniform kind of food that is most easily transformed by digestion. But many and varied qualities, being mutually opposed and hard to reconcile, spoil more readily when they clash. Just as in a city a mixed and motley crowd of people does not easily attain a single harmonious condition, but each element resists what is foreign to it and is ill-disposed toward what is alien to it. A clear proof of this concerns wine. Wines called mixed vintage intoxicate fastest, and drunkenness resembles nothing so much as the indigestion of wine. That is why drinkers avoid blended wine, while those who do the blending try to conceal it, as though plotting mischief, for change and unevenness throw one off balance. This, I suppose, is also why musicians handle instruments of many strings with great caution, since their only fault is that they are mixed and varied. For my part, I said, I can add this, that conviction and assent are more likely to arise out of conflicting arguments than digestion is out of differing qualities. But if I seem to be joking, let me leave that aside and return to Philo's arguments. For we often hear him say that, since indigestion arises from varied qualities of food, and since multiplicity of mixture is harmful, being productive of alien qualities, one ought to learn by experience what agrees with oneself and stick to that. And if nothing is naturally hard to digest, but it is quantity that causes the disturbance and corruption, then all the more, I think, must one avoid these varied and manifold dishes with which Philo's cook has just now been drugging us, like a rival craftsman, exciting our appetite by novelty and change so that it does not simply stop, but is led on to other things and oversteps, in the midst of variety, the moderate and sufficient measure, like the foster child of Hypsipyle, who, reaching from one flower to another, delighting his infant soul, insatiable, strips the meadow bare over the widest possible space. Here too one must recall Socrates, who urged us to be on guard against those foods that persuade people to eat when they are not hungry, meaning that one should be wary and fearful of nothing so much as varied and manifold foods. For this is what draws enjoyment further than need requires, in spectacles, in music, in sexual pleasures, in every kind of game and pastime, being taken up by excess, which has many starting points. Whereas in simple, single-natured pleasures, the enticement does not lead nature beyond its bounds. In general, it seems to me that one would more readily tolerate a musician praising a many-stringed instrument, or a trainer praising an abundance of perfumed oils, than a physician praising a multitude of dishes. For deviations and changes lead one off the straight road to health. When Philinus had said this, Martian said that it seemed to him that not only those who separate the profitable from the noble, but also those who set pleasure apart from health, as though it opposed and warred against it rather than cooperating with it, fell under Socrates' curse. For it is only rarely, and unwillingly, as with the most violent of instruments, he said, that we resort to pain. Whereas no one, even if he wished, could ever thrust pleasure away from any of the rest. Rather, in foods and sleep, in baths and anointings and reclining, it is always present, welcoming and nursing the sick person along, with much that is proper and in accord with nature, outshining what is foreign to it. For what pain, what deprivation, what poison ever so easily and simply resolved a disease as a bath taken at the right time, or wine given to those who need it? And food taken with pleasure at once resolves all discomforts and restores nature to its proper state, as if fair weather and calm had come. Whereas remedies achieved through painful means accomplish their work slowly and bit by bit, forcing and prying nature loose only with difficulty. Philinus, then, should not slander us if we do not, hoisting both sails, as it were, flee pleasure altogether, but rather try to combine the pleasant and the healthful more skillfully than some philosophers combine the pleasant and the noble. Now, right from the start, Philinus, in your first argument, you seem to me to have gone astray in supposing that wild animals use simpler food than men do, and are healthier for it. Neither claim is true. As to the first, Eupolis's goats testify against you, singing of their diet as thoroughly mixed and varied, in words something like these. We graze on wood of every kind, cropping the tender shoots of fir, of holm oak, of arbutus, and besides these still others, cytisus and fragrant sage, and smilax with its ivy-like leaves, wild olive, mastic, ash, poplar, oak of the aria kind, common oak, ivy, heath, buckthorn, mullein, asphodel, rockrose, valonia oak, thyme, and savory. For the plants listed have, of course, countless differences of flavor, smell, and property, and more still have been left unmentioned. As to the second claim, Homer more knowledgeably refutes it, declaring that plague first attacks the irrational animals. The brevity of their lives, too, and their liability to disease, testify against them, for practically nothing among them lives long, unless one should say the raven and the crow, which we observe to eat anything and everything indiscriminately. And moreover, in the diet you prescribe for the sick, you were not doing well when you judged foods easy or hard to digest by that standard. For exercise, training, and dividing up one's food are things that aid digestion, yet do not suit those who are feverish. And your fear of the conflict and difference among varied foods was unreasonable. For either nature draws what is proper to itself from like things directly into the body's mass, in which case varied food, releasing many qualities from itself, supplies each part with what suits it, so that Empedocles' words come true. Sweet seized on sweet, and bitter rushed upon bitter, sharp upon sharp, and the fiery took hold of the fiery, and other matter besides remains suited to the warmth, once the mixture has been dispersed in the breath, so that what is proper follows what is akin to it. For a body so thoroughly mixed and composite as ours has more reason to be replenished, and to fill out its constitution from varied matter than from simple. Or else, if this is not the case, but what we call digestion is naturally able to alter and transform food, then this will happen faster and better with varied food. For like is unaffected by like, while opposition and difference cause the qualities to be more thoroughly transformed and worn away through their mixture with their opposite. And if you reject mixture and variety altogether, Philinus, do not scold Philo here only when he is giving a dinner or having food prepared, but far more when he blends together those royal and remedial compounds, which Erasistratus called the hands of the gods, denounce the strangeness and elaborateness of mixing together, all at once, minerals, herbs, animal substances, and things from land and sea alike. For it would be far better to leave all that aside and confine medicine to barley gruel, cupping, and water-end oil, But by Zeus, you will say, variety draws out and bewitches an appetite that cannot master itself. Yes, but so, my good sir, does cleanliness and a good digestion and a pleasant smell, and in general whatever is more agreeable. These two attract us and make us more inclined to eat and drink. Why then do we not need coarse meal instead of fine, prepare wild onions and thistles instead of asparagus, and, rejecting this fragrant wine, drink instead the harsher stuff straight from the vat, serenaded by a chorus of gnats? Because you would say that a healthy regimen is not a flight from pleasure or an avoidance of it, but rather moderation and order among pleasures, keeping the appetite obedient to what is beneficial. Just as helmsmen, when the wind is fierce, use many devices to escape it, but once it has died down and faded, no one is able to fan it back up and stir it into life again. So too, to restrain and check an appetite when it is excessive is no great task. But once it has already grown weak before its time, and has become soft and is abandoning what is proper to it, to stretch it taut again and rekindle it is very difficult indeed, my friend, and hard work. That is why varied food is better than simple food, which brings on satiety through its uniformity, inasmuch as it is easier to check a nature that is still in motion than to rouse one that has given up. And indeed, what some people say, that satiety is more to be avoided than deficiency, is not true. Rather, the opposite is the case. Satiety, when it ends in some kind of corruption or disease, does harm. But deficiency, even if it produces no other evil, is in itself, of itself, contrary to nature. Let this stand, then, as a counterpoint to your philosophizing. But there is something else that seems to have escaped the notice of you, salt and bean philosophers. That varied food is more pleasant, and what is more pleasant makes for a better appetite, provided you remove the excess and overindulgence. For it attaches itself readily to a body that is eager and receptive, sight having prepared the way beforehand, whereas food that has no appeal, wandering about and roaming, is either altogether rejected by nature or accepted only reluctantly, under pressure of need. Only remember and hold on to this one point, that variety does not consist in spicy relishes and honeyed dishes and rich sauces. These are elaborate and trifling things, but Plato too provides variety for those fine, noble citizens of his, setting before them bulbs, olives, vegetables, cheese, and boiled dishes of every kind. And besides these, he does not begrudge them a share of dessert either, while they dine. Agamachus once set before us at dinner in Eli's some enormous truffles. As those present marveled, someone said with a smile, worthy indeed of the thunderclaps that occurred recently, mocking, as it were, those who say that truffles come into being from thunder. For there were those who claimed that the earth is split open by thunder, as though struck by a nail through the air, and that afterward those who go hunting for truffles use the cracks as a sign. And from this, the common belief arose that thunder actually generates the truffle, though they cannot show it doing so. Just as if someone supposed that rain makes snails, rather than merely bringing them forth and revealing them. But Agamachus stood firm on the report, and insisted that what is marvelous should not be considered incredible. And indeed, he said, there are many other marvelous effects of thunder and lightning and the celestial signs connected with them, whose causes are hard to grasp or altogether beyond our power. For indeed this truffle, laughed at and made proverbial, he said, escapes the thunderbolt not by its smallness, but because it possesses an antipathetic power, just as the fig tree does, and the skin of the seal, as they say, and that of the hyena, with which ship captains cover the tips of their sails. And farmers call the rains that come with lightning fertilizing, and believe them to be so. And in general, it is foolish to marvel at these things, while overlooking the most incredible of all the phenomena we observe in them, flames arising out of moisture, and harsh sounds being given off by soft clouds. But I am rambling on about this, he said, only to spur you on to inquire into the cause, so that I may not seem harsh in exacting payment for the truffles. I then said that in a sense I was extending a hand in agreement to Agamachus's argument, for nothing seemed more plausible, at least for the present, than that water charged with generative power often bursts out together with thunder. The cause is the mingling of heat. The sharp and pure part of the fire departs as lightning, while the heavy and vaporous part, wrapped up within the cloud and changing along with it, draws off the cold and works together to produce the. And so the moist element, being intimately combined with them, is preserved. The result being that the gentle warmth most readily penetrates growing things and quickly makes them swell. Since such influences also produce a particular quality of mixture and a difference of flavor in the things they water, just as dews make the grass sweeter for the flocks, and the clouds that bloom into the rainbow, wherever they rest upon timber, fill it with fragrance. And it is by this token that the people among us call certain kinds of wood rainbow-struck. Supposing that the rainbow settles upon them, it is far more likely that waters and winds and heat driven down into the depths by lightning and thunderbolt turn the earth and produce such convolutions and cavities as these, just as in bodies certain heats and blood-laden humors produce scrofulous and glandular swellings. For the truffle does not resemble a plant, nor does it come into being without water, but is rootless and without sprout and self-contained, its substance being formed out of earth that has undergone some affection and change. But if this account seems to you far-fetched, I said, such, after all, are most of the phenomena that accompany thunder and lightning, and it is for this very reason that these occurrences carry with them a reputation for divinity. And Dorotheus the rhetorician, who was present, said, you are right, for not only ordinary people and laymen have experienced this, but some philosophers as well. I myself know of a case. A thunderbolt fell upon a house among us and did many astonishing things. It scattered the wine out of the jars without the earthenware itself being damaged at all, and flying past a man who was asleep, it did him no harm and did not even touch his clothing, yet it melted the bronze coins in a purse he had girt about him, fusing all the money together. A Pythagorean philosopher who happened to be staying in the town came up and made inquiries about it, but the man declined to discuss it and told him to attend to his own affairs and pray to the gods. I also hear that a soldier guarding a temple in Rome had a thunderbolt fall near him that burned through the straps of his sandals, but did him no other harm. And that of some silver cup set in wooden cases, the silver melted and sank together, while the wood was found untouched and unaffected. These things one may believe or not, but the most astonishing thing of all, which practically everyone knows, is that the bodies of those killed by a thunderbolt remain free from decay. Many people, in fact, neither burn nor bury such bodies, but leave them fenced about, so that the corpses are always seen to be undecayed, contrary to the words of Euripides' Climene concerning Phaethon, that, my dear one, unwashed, rots in the ravines as a corpse. From this, I think, sulfur thane also got its name, from its likeness to the smell that things struck by lightning give off when scorched, a fiery, pungent smell, on account of which, it seems to me, both dogs and birds keep away from bodies struck by Zeus's bolt. As for me, let my account of the cause go this far, as if I had merely grazed at the laurel. As for the rest, he said, let us call upon this man here, since he has had good luck with the truffles too, so that we do not suffer the fate of Andrasides. For that painter, though of all his works the most vivid and beautiful were the fish he painted around Scylla, was thought to have been guided by his own passion rather than by his art, for he was by nature a lover of fish. So someone will say of us too, that out of sheer pleasure we have philosophized about truffles, whose origin is disputable, as you see, while in this present case the plausibility of the theory is assumed, and the fact that the cause is self-evident lends it persuasiveness. When I urged him on, saying that it was a fitting occasion, just as in comedy, when the stage machinery is raised and thunder is thrown in, to converse over wine about thunderbolts, the others let the rest pass, agreeing with what had been said, but they were eager to hear something about why people who are asleep are not struck by lightning. For my part, I gained nothing further by taking hold of the cause, since it was of common application. Nevertheless, I said that the fire of the thunderbolt is remarkable for its fineness and subtlety, having in its very origin a pure and unmixed substance, and that it shakes off and purges away anything moist or earthy that gets mingled with it, on account of the sharpness of its motion. Nothing, as Democritus says, struck by lightning from a clear sky can hold back its gleam. Now the dense bodies, iron, bronze, silver, gold, resist it, and are damaged and melted, being affected by their very resistance and opposition to it. Whereas it runs through porous, loose-textured, and yielding bodies without touching them, as it does through garments and dry wood. but green wood it burns, because the moisture in it catches and takes hold of the fire and is kindled along with it. If then it is true that people who are asleep do not die from thunderbolts, it is here and nowhere else that we must look for the cause. For the bodies of those who are awake are more firmly braced, compacted, and resistant, being filled in all their parts with pneuma, vital breath. And it is this pneuma, by turning the senses toward itself as though tuning an instrument and drawing them taut, that makes the living creature well strung, continuous with itself, and dense. But in sleep the body is relaxed, and becomes loose, uneven, slack, and diffused, and acquires many passages, since the pneuma yields and withdraws, through which sounds and smells pass freely without producing any perception of themselves. For that which resists, and which is affected precisely by resisting, does not meet what is brought against it, least of all things moving with such fineness and speed as the thunderbolt as it flies through. For nature wards off the weaker blows by means of hardness and density set up as a defense, but where the force is irresistible, the things that yield are less harmed by it than the things that stand against it. Add to this, I said, no small element of shock and fear and terror in the face of such events, from which many, though suffering nothing else, have died from the very fright of dying. Indeed, shepherds teach their flocks, when thunder occurs, to run together and huddle close, since those left scattered by fear miscarry. And one may see countless people already dead from thunder who bear no trace either of a blow or of burning, but whose souls, it seems, have flown out of their bodies like birds through sheer fear. For as Euripides says, the bloodless blast of thunder has destroyed many. And indeed, quite apart from this, hearing is the most effect-prone of the senses, and the greatest disturbances are produced by frights and shocks caused through sound, against which the sleeper's insensibility is a defense. Those who are awake, on the other hand, are worn down also by the prior distress, and since fear truly binds, contracts, and condenses the body, they make the blow, by their very resistance to it, a powerful one. At the wedding of my son Autobulus, Sosius Senecian, who had come from Chaeronea, was present and shared the celebration with us. And among the many other topics that suited the occasion, he raised for discussion the reason why most people invite so many guests to wedding banquets besides the rest. For the lawgivers who fought most vigorously against extravagance were especially careful to set limits on the number of those invited to weddings.